That's Molly Birch and Heart of Gold with Prime Circle ahead of that one. Hello. And Brian Ferry kicking off the triple play, Slave to Love. It's 8:30 on a Wednesday. And our attorney at law, Gavin Steinhobel from Kloppers Inc., is in the house, along with Penny Faree, our investigative journalist, because, well, there is big stuff happening very, very shortly on the North Coast and quite dramatic stuff as well. Penny has the details.
Good morning, Dave. Good morning, Gavin. Thank you for having me on your show.
Yeah, cool.
I know in recent months, we've been tracking a surge of land invasions across Kwadukuza from Belita to Stanga. And what's worrying is that these invasions aren't just informal settlements. Many of these are full brick and mortar houses going up on private farms and land earmarked for development, all without any legal authority, sold through a shadow network of brokers and doonies or self-appointed middlemen. And it's a growing economy of land crime, built obviously on exploitation and little enforcement. And in recent case, the sheriff is actually preparing to demolish dozens of illegal structures after a high court order. And it's raising serious questions about how the law has been applied and whether municipalities are doing enough to prevent it. And Gavin, this is where you come in with your legal expertise. How does South African law actually define land invasions? Is it the moment someone actually builds or occupies or refuses to leave? Where does the grey line start?
I think before you really have any conversation along these lines, you need to go back to first principles and say, how did we get here? You know, what is the legal framework that we exist in? And, you know, pre-1994, obviously, property rights were strictly enforced, and anybody trespassing or building structures on another property would be summarily evicted, and there would be no issue about it. Obviously, after 1994, we moved into our new constitutional era, and under Section 25 of that constitution, there was an obvious need to have some legislation which speaks to the past and land, because that is always a big political football in this country. And Section 25 put on the government the obligation, one, is to address previous inequities, people who were dispossessed of their land due to racial legislation, and secondly, also to give some security of tenure to people who are, for example, vulnerable, like farm workers and communities that live in rural areas. So to give them some kind of security in their homes, that they won't just summarily be evicted without good cause and without resorting to the courts first. So in that sort of milieu, obviously there was an obligation on government to pass some legislation. And I'm just going to run through the most important acts. Right in 94, we had our Restitution of Land Rights Act, which is, in my opinion, a very good act because it was fair. So what the act essentially provided for was that if you're a community or a group of people who were dispossessed of your land under historically racially based legislation, for example, you were moved from an area that would be exclusively white to an area that was now, going to be exclusively black or colored, then you could have some claim to the, if you had some proof that your community came from there and you lived there and that you were forcibly removed, you could have a claim to that land. Now, where I say it was a good piece of legislation, because it was using taxpayer money to reimburse the person who's currently the owner of that land, okay, if the community wanted the land. Alternatively, the community could choose to take the money. And guess what you've just done? You've had redress for past wrongs. And it is a good system, and it would have been a good system. But like all things that happened under our ANC government, it soon became riddled with incompetence and corruption. And several claims were not processed, and the dates were extended, and the whole thing didn't deliver what it ought to have delivered. It should have been a closure of the book on that chapter of our history.
Yeah.
And it didn't happen. It happened for some, and there were some very good, there are some good stories. I think most communities took the money. The One of the glaring problems with what happened is that all of the communities that took the land, almost without exception, those farms failed and are currently uneconomical and a disaster.
Just, if I may come in, why do you think that is? Because presumably, and I don't
know, that's rather obvious. And one is that anything that's owned collectively is never looked after.
Ah.
Because you need individual ownership of property, because then you'll be a good steward to the property, because you're the sole beneficiary of that property, and you'll look after it, and you'll probably want your children to inherit it. If all of us own it, nobody's really directly benefiting from it.
And but is that not the principle of the Ngonyama Trust? No one owns the land. Everyone works.
I'm going to get to the Ngonyama Trust if you don't mind. No problem. Fine. So we ended up with a situation where we did have what was on face value a very good resolve to past injustice and a way to put it behind us and move forward in a non-racial way. One must also remember that many of the people that now own property in these areas that were disputed had lawfully acquired it sometime after the evictions and the removal of people. And they'd paid for it, and they'd taken bonds and repaid their bonds. They'd worked the land. They'd built dams. They've broken new fields, and they've made productive farms there. So, you know, it would be deeply iniquitous just to take it from them, because several generations ago there was some query about how it was acquired. So this is how we ended up with what I thought was a very good solution. Unfortunately, the implementation, as usual with anything relating to government, was shoddy. Right. Another thing that came when I was a young attorney in the 90s, I suddenly came across a situation where you wanted to evict people who were patently and unlawfully in occupation of somebody else's property. There were two acts. One was the Extension of Security of Tenure Act, and the other one was the Prevention of Illegal Eviction and, which we always forget, Unlawful Occupation of Land Act. Both of those acts were aimed at just ensuring that people who wanted to evict anyone from their property at least took recourse to the courts and didn't take the law into their own hands, which again is a sound principle. But unfortunately, there were all sorts of additional requirements that were laid down. One of the things that, for example, the court had to consider was all of the constitutional rights of the people that were in unlawful occupation. For example, the right to education. Are there young children who now won't be able to go to school if you evict them and they have to go to some other area, and so forth and so forth? So suddenly what you'd done is you'd actually diluted this clear right you have to evict people and created a whole lot of little hurdles that had to be overcome before the court would really see its way clear to eviction. And obviously in that mood of uncertainty that existed at the time, the magistrates and judges were reluctant really just to put their necks out. And so they tried to make people go through all these little jumps and hoops before they could actually do an eviction. So it created sort of almost a perception that that eviction is a very difficult thing to achieve.
Well, it is a difficult thing to
achieve. And we know that now. Yeah. And then what happens is that that creates obviously some incentive to occupy land, because you know that your chances of being evicted are 50-50, and even if it's the 50 that goes against you, it's going to take an awful long time to get there.
Gavin, I wanted to ask you just on that particular point. What I'm seeing now is that the odds are stacked against property owners. They are facing crippling legal costs.
Well,
and it takes months.
Yeah, let's move through it. I mean, let's have a look at, then we also had a situation where just on the land issue, because I think you need to sort of take the 1,000-foot view of it. One of the things that has also happened is that under the old Native Trust Land Act of 1936, after 1994, a lot of the previous TBVC state land was put into trust for the communities. Again, I've said that in my view, collective ownership of land always ends up with the land not being looked after. And you can see that whenever you cross any kind of border into the Transkei or the Old Siskei, or and you look at all the soil erosion and the bad farming practices, it's because it's not really owned by anybody. Whereas if you're in the old South African side of things, you'll see neat farms. You know, you won't see erosion, you won't see overgrazing, and so forth. So it's the difference between collective and individual ownership of land, really. So one of the things that they pushed through in 94, as on the eve of our new dawn, was the Ingwenyama Trust, where they put 2.8 million hectares of KZN land into trust, and the trustee was the Zulu King at the time. What that means is that one out of every 3 hectares in this province can't be individually owned, and has to be owned in the, or is owned by this trust. That means that the people that live there cannot have title deeds. And not having a title deed to the property that you live on is crippling economically. The reason is you can never take your property to the bank and raise a bond like all of us can who have our title deeds. The second is you can't sell your land. It has zero value. So when you leave, they simply give somebody else a permission to occupy that land and you leave with nothing. So and you can't acquire your neighbor's land. So for example, if you're a very good farmer, you might say, well, I'm farming a hectare. Maybe I'll start buying a hectare next to me. That chap doesn't look like he's farming. I can buy it from him and farm that. And so that's how big farms come into existence, is they buy their less productive neighbors up. And so on a, you almost condemn the people that live in that system to almost a feudalistic existence where they're serfs and they pay rent to the king. So
you know, Velenkosin Hlabisa had a different view, and he put it quite nicely on an interview that I watched recently, where he said, you know, it's a Western concept that this ownership of land and title deed is a valuable commodity. His point is that it actually is a kind of economic slavery, because you don't own that land, the bank does. You'll work your entire life to try to acquire the title deed. But he says his system, or the Ingwenyama Trust system, works in on the permission to occupy basis, which is a legal document, he reckons, that is tradable. In other words, once you have from the chief that is entitled to apportioned land in his district, a permission to occupy document, you can sell that document to the next permission to occupy person wishing to acquire it. The point is this: you don't have to buy the land. You can't raise a bond against it, but you can build as you can afford to.
That's such a fallacious argument. First of all, I don't want to own my land subject to the government or some permission from a chief or a minister. I want to own it because I own it and I have a title deed, okay? The fact that I have to...
But you don't until the bank gives you the title deed, which is maybe 20...
No, you own the property. You've given it to the bank as security for money that you took from the bank, okay?
But if you don't repay the bank, you don't own the property.
Well, you've got no right to own the property. You never bought it.
That's what the point is.
That's fallacious, because when you have paid your property off, it's yours. And then, like anything else you have in life, you pay for it. You can't say, "Well, I don't think we should have a system where I acquire a car and I go to WesBank or whoever finances cars these days, and now it's not my car."
But there are those that choose to lease, for example, which is a pretty similar.
If you lease it, you have nothing to give the bank as security, and you'll never raise any finance. So it is just economically crippling. In fact, the first time that Western society really got cracking was when we had private land ownership, and you didn't have to farm the land owned by your local lord. And so, it is enormously important for economic growth and for people to uplift themselves, for them to be able to own the land that they're on. And it is fallacious to argue otherwise. And I'll tell you what as well, is that when everything's owned by a small cabal of people, like, for example, the trust, it's well known that, first of all, people are just asked to move and there's mining going on and all the money is paid to this trust, and the people who were previously there just don't get anything. And, it's always a bad idea for ownership to vest, in one entity or one group of trustees. Because what about the people, don't we trust them? Are they incapable of running their own affairs? You know, I know that there's a fear that they might sell their property. You know, they might not sell it to the people that that the trustees like. But the point of the matter is that is a very archaic way to run land, and it's a very unproductive way, as you can see when you drive through that land. So I think it's a huge economic break on those people, and that is why there's a dissatisfaction with the land regime at the moment. Now, your permission to occupy letter, yes, it gives you permission. Go take it to the bank and see how much credibility they give it. None. Because they won't lend you any money against it. And why did they give it none? Because they know it's not legally enforceable. That is not. And we're unfortunately in a situation in this country where we have a two-tier system. We've got the old system where people still want to live like they did in the 1500s. And then we've got the modern system, which is everything outside of these trusts, where people have title deeds and there's a rule of law. Now, what Benny's dealing with is the fact that these people that are affected by this in our area, and I'm sure you're going to go yes. into detail on it in future,
yeah.
They do have title deeds. And they do, their right to land ownership is also protected under the same section of the Constitution, Section 25. And that title deed is good against all comers.
What I've got a question. In cases where people, which is happening right now, claim that they've bought the land through a traditional authority or community structure.
They haven't bought the land. They can't
buy, well, that's what they claim.
Buy the land.
Does that hold any legal standing under South African law?
Under our law, if I buy land from you, I only become the owner of that land when the registrar's stamp comes down on my new title deed in the Pietermaritzburg deeds office. Okay. Before that, I don't own it. I might have paid you in full. I still don't own it. You still own it. And until the registrar's stamp comes down and I have the new title deed and your title deed is cancelled, you the owner until that moment. When that ink hits the paper, I'm the owner.
Well, many of the land claimants that I spoke to this week and last week have said that they bought the land through the chief, and the land belongs to the chief.
You see, that's the old Ingonyama Trust deal.
Yes,
yes. If it was within, you see, the land that the Ingonyama Trust is on has a title deed, or all the various portions of land that make up the total. Each of those title deeds has as the owner the Ingonyama Trust, right? Now, if they've seconded a chief to that area, and they've given him the right to give people permission to live there, then well, that's fine. But remember, they're just tenants; they're not owners. They don't own the land that they're on. They can't own it because it's in a title deed that reflects the Ingonyama Trust as the owner of that land. Now, the land that they're invading, there's a title deed, and it reflects somebody else as the owner, and
yes.
that somebody else is quite unhappy that the chief is giving away bits of his land.
Yeah,
and it's obviously wrong, and that's why the sheriff has an order now to demolish. And
yeah.
I've seen the photos of the matter that you're talking about, and I'm familiar with it. And you know, it's not like people have come and put up shacks. They've put up, you know, three, four
proper
bedroom houses. They've got proper foundations.
Yes.
They're well constructed, brick and mortar, proper roofing. And the horror of horrors is that it appears that KDM have hooked them up to water and sanitation.
Yes.
Wow.
And,
yeah.
and electricity.
Well, KDM, I did ask them, I have sent them the proof of the photos that I took and have asked them to respond, and they haven't yet. Responded. I also sent it to the legal department. Just on that issue, that point on law and responsibility, if you're a private property owner and this has happened, people have invaded your land, where does KDM, according to the law, step in? Do they have a legal obligation to protect private property owners?
Well, the first of all, your first port of call would be the SAP, and you'd say, look, you know, I've got people on my land, this is my title deed, and they're coming on without permission. That's normally something that you could probably attempt in the early stages of an invasion like this, because they're going to have to get the police out there. Now, as we know, I mean, the police are very disinclined to get involved in this kind of
yes,
thing, and they go,
yes.
well, it's a civil matter, it should really be dealt with by the courts, and we're not going to be judge and jury of the situation. which really to me is shirking their obligation, because if there's a title deed owner, he's quite obviously the sole person who can give permission for people to enter his land or to live on his land, and if he says I haven't given it, it's case closed.
Well, what happens if the SAPS said you need to get an eviction first before we can step in?
Well, what they do, once somebody's become established, okay, and that means they've probably built some kind of structure and they now basically what we colloquially call squatters, they've now basically occupied the land and they seem to have established themselves there. Now you'll need to go to the court, and then you'll under the under ESTA, the Extension of Security of Tenure Act, you'd have to jump through those hoops that I mentioned earlier and say to the court, well, I need these people evicted. It is my land. It's inconveniencing me and I don't want them there, and I've got other plans for the land. And now you get into the morass of, well, where are they going to go? Now, the court, everybody's a little bit gun-shy of the sort of forced removals that we had in this country in the apartheid era.
But this is going to happen in the next day or so.
Not day, week.
The next week or so.
But regardless, what I'm saying is the arguments will be put up, well, you know, where are these people going to go? And that's where the KDM comes in, because they do, in fact, have sit on large tracts of land that are owned by the municipality, and they could accommodate people if housing was the issue. Right. This matter that we're speaking about, that is in fact earmarked for low cost housing, and so by these people invading it now, they're actually making the housing situation worse.
Yeah.
Because the low cost housing that would have happened there might not happen now. And that would have been an ordered and sort of a correct way of approaching the problem, but it's not. It doesn't smack of desperados that have moved in here. It's purely opportunists.
Absolutely.
And if you think, because a desperado might come with four bits of corrugated iron and make himself some sort of lean-to shelter. But when somebody is spending hundreds of thousands up to millions of rands constructing proper dwellings that we'd be quite happy with in Belito, then you know it's an opportunistic situation where the sense, and I think in a sense this was given by an act I haven't spoken about, but the new Expropriation Act, it was given the sense that, well, you know, if we overrun property and there can be no compensation, we might actually score some land for free. And I think that lies at the heart of this, and the rest is all nonsense.
Yeah, and just to go back to it in the legal obligation of the municipality, are they governed by any law that, you know, protects the property owner? I know Spluma was mentioned as well, and we've seen obviously that double standard here.
When you as an owner are enforcing your rights, whether it be your rights to your land or your rights to any other asset you have, you turn to the SAP first, and then you turn to the courts. And KDM's job is not to evict people. Okay, but KDM, if there is a situation where people need to be relocated, they have to come to the party. They have to uphold the constitution. Everybody's got a right to live somewhere, and they have to assist with that. So their role is more a facilitatory role. It's certainly, if it's true that they've hooked these people up to services, then they're doing the complete opposite of what they should be doing. They should be upholding the law.
Or possibly someone shady in the electricity department who's making a side bug.
Well, you know, the irony of this is that if the landowner there, who's also a property developer, were to initiate a property development without all the SPLUMA applications and all the and start connecting up people, he would be stopped on the same day that he tried to do it. So it seems like a bit of a two-tier policing there. Yeah. You know, KDM should be out there and disconnecting all those connections and advising people that what they're doing is going to end badly, because ultimately in the short term they might have occupied land and then to their detriment have now gone and built structures which are going to be demolished. That's a lot of money they've lost.
Yeah.
And they've been foolhardy in doing this. And the fact that the High Court has decided that, yes, they should be demolished is in and of itself quite a, you know, I think we should all take heart from that.
Yeah.
Because at least land ownership But you're still sitting in a situation where this could have been nipped in the bud. Yeah. That landowner has gone to enormous legal expense, and I am aware of what they're spending just to get to this point.
What happens if the landowner doesn't have the funds and the capacity to take this to court? What
yeah, the reality in life is your rights only go as far as your wallet does.
Yeah,
and if you don't have money to enforce your rights, then you will get taken advantage of. So ultimately, in this case. We're all watching with great interest because, we are also, this case is resonant not just locally but nationally, because this expropriation of land with zero compensation has become a political football, and it is causing a lot of grief for us internationally as well, because that's just the one thing that you become a pariah state if government starts taking property from citizens without paying for it. And so it is a very important issue, and we should all watch it with great interest because it's got a big bearing on where we're going as a country. I'm heartened by the fact that the courts at least see that the law must be upheld. You know, what happened in Zimbabwe, and that is something we have to guard against, is Zimbabwe didn't just start by taking land from white farmers and giving it to all comers or all the ex-soldiers or whatever. It started with unchecked land invasions, and then when they got away with one, they realized they could get away with all of them, and they overran all those farms. And so it's very, very important that a loud and clear message be sent out that this is not a country where that would be tolerated. You know, we have courts, we have systems, and you have to work through them. And if the owner is going to be put to that, then, you know, so would people who want to occupy land. Ultimately, I don't think that we have a land crisis. I just think that we have productive land and land that's been neglected, and people would rather have the productive land, obviously.
Yeah.
And there we leave it for today. Gavin Steinhobel, our attorney at law, will be back in a week's time. This has been an extended chat, but I think very, very important under the circumstances. We will watch that development up the road very closely. Penny Faree, investigative journalist, has prepared herself to take on the challenge of reporting on this matter. And we look forward to bringing you the information because, well, you have the right